A new beginning for Zimbabwe today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Zimbabwe's president, Robert Mugabe, resigns after 37 years in power. Some say it's long overdue.
We were tired of this man. We are so glad he's gone. We don't want him anymore. And yes, today it's victory.
Also, how mandatory military service makes Israelis think about guns differently.
For them, a gun is not some theoretical recreational thing. It's a burden you're forced to carry when you're 18. You don't want it. You'll go to jail if you lose it. And then the second you're done with it, you don't want to see it again.
Plus, remembering when record companies made special vinyl LPs to promote travel destinations like Cuba.
And if you never got to go to Cuba, you can just put the record on and dance in your living room.
All that's ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us. In recent days, we've been paying special attention to what's going on in Zimbabwe, in southern Africa. And today, we can tell you that it is truly the end of an era in that country, a 37-year era, to be precise. That's how long Robert Mugabe ruled Zimbabwe, first as prime minister and then as president. Today, in a letter to parliament, he announced his resignation, and then... That was a scene inside Zimbabwe's parliament building after the speaker announced Mugabe would be stepping down. And in the streets of the country, Zimbabwean journalist Ish Mafandika sent us this from right outside the capital, Harare.
As you can hear in the background, it's total chaos. I'm trying to get into this city, into downtown Harare from my house, which is just about 5 minutes away from the city center. You can hear for yourself that the people are really, really happy. They are excited and celebrating the fall of Robert Mugabe. I've seen some people crying, actually, because for a lot of young people who are the majority in this country, this is the only leader that they've known. So it's pretty emotional. As a journalist, I'm kind of excited, really. Like now, I'm on the street corner speaking into my microphone. And that was kind of suicidal in the past. You know, the police would harass you, and the army would harass you, and people were suspicious. And I hope that now, in terms of freedom of speech, Zimbabweans will be open to talking to journalists, making our job much easier, because before we were regarded with so much suspicion. But I hope that this will bring about a change where people are free to express themselves.
Zimbabwean journalist Ish Mafandika there. And here's a little more of what we're hearing from Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, today.
I am so happy. I can't believe it.
That's Linda Masarira, a human rights activist who's been jailed in the past for her opposition to Mugabe.
And now I believe that I did not suffer in vain. I suffered for a reason. I'm the happiest person under the sun right now because I always believed that Mugabe was going to step down in my lifetime. And it has happened. And now going forward, it's time for opposition to reorganize and ensure that we will have a government that cares for the people and everyone has to be included. It's a happy day today. Independence is finally here.
Robert Mugabe's former vice president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, is expected to take over. And one Zimbabwean in exile says today is a good day.
Yeah, I can't believe it. It's a good feeling for the people of Zimbabwe.
That's musician Thomas Mapfumo. Actually, he's one of Africa's best-known musicians, which makes him arguably Zimbabwe's best-known artist. When Zimbabwe was still Rhodesia, the white minority regime imprisoned Mapfumo without charges. Mapfumo supported fighters like Robert Mugabe during the War for Liberation. But after independence, Mapfumo began to see Mugabe for the authoritarian he turned into. And that became dangerous for Mapfumo when he started to write songs about that. Mapfumo has lived in exile in Oregon for several years and has not been back to Zimbabwe since 2005. I got Thomas Mapfumo's reaction to the news of Mugabe's resignation earlier today.
I think the people have taken the country back, which is a good thing. I feel so good. I feel relieved.
So Mugabe came into power as a liberation fighter. He helped the country throw off the yoke of British colonialism. He forged an independent nation. he was a hero for so many people for so long. When did you start to see a less heroic side of Robert Mugabe?
That was after 8 years of black rule. And then I started, noticing that there was corruption within the government. And that made me to write that song, Corruption. A lot of other people who were affiliated with this government were not happy with the song, but a lot of people were very happy that I managed to mention something that was happening within our country.
Yeah, and this is a contrast because during the struggle for liberation, when the country was still Rhodesia, you supported Mugabe, you supported his fight. What was Mugabe's reaction when you came out with a song that basically called him out?
Basically, I wasn't supporting him as an individual. I was supporting the struggle. I thought, if we were going to have a black government, our people were going to be free from the colonial rule. But that wasn't to be. And to me, it doesn't matter who is the white or black. If you do wrong things, I'll still sing about you.
So your music is called Chimurenga music. That's a Shona word for liberation or liberation struggle. When you saw this less heroic side of Mugabe, how did that affect your liberation music?
That was a big problem for me because they banned my music from being played on the radio. They didn't want me to tell the people the truth about what was happening. And I even mentioned it when I was in England, and I mentioned that Mugabe was a dictator. And it came out with the local newspapers in Zimbabwe. It was headlines that Mukanya, as they call me, is fighting against Mugabe.
So remind us what led you to leave Zimbabwe.
I was thinking of the future of my children. There was no future for them in that country anymore. They wanted to go on with their education. So I thought if I could move here, it was going to be the right thing for my children.
Will you return to Zimbabwe? Because a lot of people want to know. If you go online, there's a lot of discussion about Thomas Mafumo. Will he come back? Won't he come back? I mean, it seems it would be massively symbolic for a lot of people if you return to Zimbabwe.
Yes, of course, I would like to go back to Zimbabwe. But let's not forget that these are the same people who used to work with Mugabe. Just because some of them have been fired from the party, and then they come back saying Mugabe is bad. We don't know how good they are themselves. We are keeping our fingers crossed.
What about the next generation of musicians? Do you feel that there are musicians in Zimbabwe today who can kind of speak with the same voice that you have, that you've had, and kind of call politicians out when they need to be called out?
Nobody is doing that today because most of them were very much afraid of the regime. But I don't take that. I'm not afraid of anyone, the white regime, the black regime. My message doesn't change just because you are black. And then just because I happen to be a black man too, I have to support you just because of the color of your skin. I don't do that. I'm not a racist myself.
Thomas Mafumo speaking with us from his home in Eugene, Oregon. We wish you the best. And if you do make it back to Zimbabwe, we'd love to speak with you when you're back home.
Thank you so much, sir.
The 2010 earthquake in Haiti left the country's buildings, its entire economy, in ruins. The dire situation forced about 60,000 Haitians to seek and find refuge here in the U.S. That refuge, Temporary Protected Status, or TPS. It's allowed those Haitians a chance to be here, get work permits, and send remittances back home to help Haiti rebuild. Some have children who are now U.S. citizens. But as the TPS name says, it's always been temporary. And yesterday, the Department of Homeland Security announced it will terminate TPS for Haitians, which means that now the 60,000 Haitians have only 18 months to leave the U.S. The World's Kenya Downs has been looking into this. So how exactly are Haitians affected by the end of TPS, Kenya?
Because of the end of TPS, Haitians will have until July 22nd, 2019 to essentially pack up their lives, many of whom have been here for more than 10 years and before the earthquake even hit. And so it's going to be a complete uprooting of a life they've built here in the U.S.
So the Trump administration says that in coming to this decision, they determined Haiti has made significant progress in recovering from the earthquake. What do the policy experts say about the situation in Haiti? Would they agree?
Well, many disagree. In fact, Haiti has had quite a few setbacks since the earthquake itself, including a cholera outbreak when UN workers from Nepal brought the virus onto the island and it killed thousands. There were subsequent hurricanes that destroyed the island and much of its agriculture on top of the infrastructure that was demolished in the earthquake. So Haitians have come a long way, but much of the political instability has existed before the earthquake even hit. So it's actually quite dangerous for many of the Haitians who are here in the United States to return.
Right. Not everyone who came to the U.S. came because of the 2010 earthquake in Haiti, right? I mean, there are Haitians who have been here much longer.
Yes, absolutely. Haitians who were already in the country, whether on a temporary visa or undocumented, were able to apply for TPS as well. So some of the 60,000 affected are folks who've been here for decades and generally have deep roots in their communities. Many are actually business owners. In fact, I spoke with Ronnie Pentio. He's a nurse practitioner in Miami Gardens, Florida, and he's been here for over 18 years. He and his wife are both TPS recipients after unsuccessfully seeking asylum, and his two children are American born. Now, obviously, they're devastated and worried.
I don't have a job in Haiti. I don't have a house. I don't have anything. And I left the country since 1999. If they're going to deport, they're going to deport the family, the parents. So it's a difficult situation. What can I do? Leave the kids here?
Yeah, that is a serious dilemma. How are other Haitian immigrants responding to the end of TPS, Kenya?
Well, even though it's generally perceived among Haitian communities that President Trump had a more antagonistic approach to immigration than his predecessor, many were still shocked. Trump had a small amount of support among Haitians in South Florida because he specifically campaigned to them there by visiting Miami's Little Haiti community and openly criticizing his opponent, former Secretary Hillary Clinton, who is very unfavorable among Haitians because of the many controversies between the Clinton Foundation and its post-earthquake relief efforts in Haiti. So there's a sense of feeling betrayed and deceived. But mainly there's a chilling effect among the Haitian community about what happens next, and even among other Caribbean nations, because there have been quite a few natural disasters in the Caribbean islands that could make countries like Antigua and Barbuda or Dominica eligible for TPS in the future.
So what happens after the deadline hits in July 2019?
Well, these immigrants, if they do remain in the U.S., will become undocumented and therefore eligible for detention or deportation. And many of these people have American-born children, like we mentioned. And when I spoke with Ronnie's 10-year-old daughter, Ronde Christina, it was already creating a deep anxiety among them.
Well, my father would be deported and I'd be very sad because who's going to take care of me? They are hardworking people and they don't deserve to go. A lot of kids have never been to Haiti before, or wherever they were from, wherever their parents were from. This is all I know.
So it's up to Congress now to pass legislation that could permanently resolve their status, whether that be permanent residency or some form of visa that would especially apply to them.
And how likely is some kind of relief going to be from Congress?
Well, last week, a bipartisan bill was introduced that would possibly allow those who've been here at least 5 years to apply for permanent residency, as well as create a different type of temporary status that provides more protections. A vote prior to the TPS expiration date will be critical as other nations in vulnerable Latin American countries see their TPS status as subject to termination. There doesn't seem to be much optimism among the Haitian immigrants in the South Florida area, but there is some sense that the advocacy that we're seeing from Haitian and other immigrant groups on the Hill could have some impact in legislation being passed before the deadline.
The World's Kenya Downs, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, a gun culture shaped by mandatory military service. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. Last Friday, we brought you a special edition of the show focused on gun culture across the globe, and we wondered if there are lessons for the United States in how other countries deal with firearms and gun ownership. There are plenty. You can find more of our coverage at PRI.org/guns. But the truth is, there is so much we can learn from other countries. We could have produced at least two shows about guns. So here's another perspective, the view from Israel, where gun culture differs dramatically from the U.S. Ben Hartman is a writer and reporter based in Tel Aviv. And before we get to what you see in terms of gun culture in Israel, tell us about your own experience with guns, because you grew up near Austin, Texas. I've seen open carry parades in Austin, but what was your own experience growing up there? Were guns part of your upbringing?
I mean, I grew up in Austin, and my parents were and grew up middle class Jewish community and whatnot. But, you know, even though that's not a conservative rural background in rural Texas, guns are still not something that's all that strange or distant. Everybody I know from there, I think at some point in their life has shot a gun or gone to a shooting range or maybe hunting, or their parents have guns at the house. It's just not something that's distant or that defines your politics.
I gather you were a counselor at a Jewish camp in Texas. Did you shoot guns there?
Yeah, I was thinking that was probably the first place I shot actual, live ammunition. When you're in the oldest boys bunk, so about 12 years old, 13 years old, you would be able to shoot 22. You know, it's just a low caliber, low velocity 22 short round, but it's still, you know, that's a lethal round that will kill somebody. And so by 12 years old, you know, we were able to shoot if you wanted to. And that's a kind of funny thing, because it didn't really strike me at the time as being odd. And here are these kids at this Jewish summer camp, most of them, you know, from suburban areas of Houston or Austin or Dallas, and you know, middle class or upper middle class liberal parents and whatnot. And I don't think anybody thought anything of it as far as I remember. I think to a certain extent in America, but especially in places like Texas and other similar areas, there's a sort of nonchalance about it, in addition to the sort of fetish that a lot of people have as well around guns.
And then you move to Israel, and visitors who go there often notice that firearms are pretty visible in public. I remember sitting once in a cafe in Jerusalem. A guy walks in for a latte and lays his cell phone and Glock on the table and places order. It's almost banal. Did that stand out to you when you first moved to Israel after being in Texas?
Yeah, it's something you tend to get used to after a while in Israel. For instance, riding the Tel Aviv to Jerusalem bus, and there'll be a machine gun across the aisle pointing at your chest the whole time while the soldier is, you know, napping on the way to Jerusalem. And you just see it. It's very common on the streets, especially in places like big bus depots and train stations, places where you see a lot of soldiers and security personnel. So it's a rather ironic situation where, like you were saying, you know, visitors are often taken aback by the amount of firearms they see. But on the other hand, every single one of those firearms is accounted for and has a reason that the person has it.
Right. I was going to ask you, I mean, how hard is it to get a gun in Israel?
It's quite difficult. And I think that touches on the central difference between the gun culture, the gun world in Israel versus America. In America, it's a right, and here it's a privilege that you have to earn. So every one of those people you see with a gun, they had to be over 21, an Israeli resident for more than 3 years. They had to pass a mental and physical health exam, background checks by the Public Security Ministry, shooting exams, courses, licensed gun range to make sure that you can actually fire the gun. And then you're given the one firearm. But before running through all those hoops, you have to have some sort of established on paper security reason. You have to show, okay, I work in security or law enforcement, or that you live in what they call national priority areas. That is often West Bank settlements or places on the border with Gaza or Lebanon that they consider high danger areas. And then you are only able to have one single firearm with a one-time supply of 50 bullets from a licensed dealer. And then every couple of years, you have to take another licensing exam. But every one of those firearms that you see out there, you know that there's a reason that that person has it, which can be comforting. In other words, if I'm walking down the street in Texas or, I don't know, somewhere in America, and somebody has an assault rifle there, I don't know that they have a reason.
So, Ben, how did that happen? How did it come about that Israelis view guns so differently than we Americans, especially when it comes to firearms being well regulated?
You know, it's something I think about often. Legislation is very important, but it's also cultural. And, you know, you can change the legislation in America theoretically, but the culture is still there and it's so powerful. And in Israel, you don't have that same sort of gun fetish and recreational obsession with guns. And I believe it's partly because the universal draft here, the fact that for Israelis, when they encounter firearms for the first time on a personal level, it's in the military. It's when they're 18 years old and they're drafted. And a firearm to them, the association is with the military and with security and a burden. It's something that they have to do, and it's not something that they want to do recreationally. So that already changed the association that somebody has with the firearm. And then on top of that, you have the security situation in Israel over the years, terrorism, the wars and all that. So firearms are very much associated with the security situation, and law enforcement and security officials and all that see too much of a public security danger in having unregulated guns out there in society. For them, a gun is not some theoretical recreational thing. It's a burden you're forced to carry when you're 18. You're given this, you don't want it, you're responsible for it, you'll go to jail if you lose it. And then the second you're done with it, you don't want to see it again.
The U.S. leads the world in mass shootings. How often do they happen in Israel?
Well, the only one I can think of was one that happened that I covered in May 2013. It was in Be'er Sheva in southern Israel. A disgruntled man went in and he shot and killed four people. He was a private security guard, so he had the gun through his work. That's why he got approval for that gun. But he had been suspended or he had been out of work. There had been some sort of, if I remember correctly, a domestic violence complaint. So he kind of fell through the cracks. He shouldn't have had that firearm. And already the next day, you had talk about tightening and changing some of the regulations. And they passed regulations that sort of eased up things in 2000 when the second Intifada happened and you had suicide bombings becoming very common in Israel. You had this huge boom in the private security industry because suddenly every cafe, every restaurant, every mall wanted to put a security guard with a pistol at the front door. So suddenly then you had a whole lot more firearms out there in the civilian sector. That's the thing, is that while they are strict, they're flexible. An incident can happen like a terror wave and they can ease up. An incident can happen like a mass shooting in Be'er Sheva and they tighten. So you have this sort of ebb and flow where there's always strict regulations, but the extent to where they're strict can be somewhat fluid and change considering the events in society. It's very different in the States. In the States, there's this sort of approach that, you know, even after something like in Las Vegas or the Pulse nightclub or Newtown, you just can't touch these laws.
Do you think that this high degree of caution over firearms in Israel, did it originate at all at the formation of the country in 1948 in some way?
Well, there's no constitution in Israel, which is a whole other problem. That's another conversation. But right. There's always been, you know, as opposed to America, a much greater belief in the state having a monopoly on the use of force, the state having a monopoly on security and the means of using force. Whereas in America, you don't have that same approach as much. In fact, there's a sort of hostile approach towards the state. And in Israel, you don't really have that. And it crosses all lines. You can ask, you know, very right-wing Israelis or very left-wing Israelis. It doesn't matter. They're quite likely to say, you know, the situation in America is rather absurd. There was a joke going around in Israel after the Las Vegas shooting. They said, you know, kind of crazy. In America, they won't let you get on a flight with a bottle of water, but they'll let this guy walk up to his hotel room with duffel bags full of rifles. You know, that country's messed up. And there's not much you can say to that.
Reporter and writer Ben Hartman in Tel Aviv, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, why the world's largest candy maker is sinking big money into renewable energy.
Using less energy in your factories just saves you money. You know, the world has reached a tipping point on renewable energy where it's actually cheaper now in many countries than fossil fuel energy. So it's just good business, some of this.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The latest global climate summit in Bonn is over. The U.S. did not blow the process up or bog it down significantly, as many had feared. So the Paris Agreement to tackle the climate crisis is still alive and kicking. And you can almost hear the collective exhale around the world this week. Still, if we're going to avoid the worst effects of climate change, the challenges ahead are immense. So today, our Livable Planet desk brings us two stories about how two very different players are approaching the problem. We're going to start with the world's Carolyn Beeler right here in Boston.
I spend a lot of time at work thinking about climate change as this big, complex international policy issue. What I get to think about less is what cutting our carbon footprint actually looks like. Will all of our energy have to come from wind and solar? Or will all of our cars have to be electric? Will capturing and storing carbon ever really work? So when I heard a while back about this spreadsheet that a Harvard professor uses to help his students model a low-carbon future, I was pretty excited. Not because I'm really into spreadsheets, because I'm really not, but because it seemed so concrete.
How are you going to supply jet fuel in a low-carbon world?
This is that Harvard environmental science professor, Dan Schrag.
What are you going to do about passenger vehicles? What are you going to do about home heating and air conditioning?
I'm going to just take you really briefly through an overview.
I got to sit in on Schrag's environmental science class at Harvard this fall while he introduced the exercise.
The idea is to take this grand problem and break it up into the different sectors in which we actually use energy.
Schrag points to tabs at the bottom of an Excel spreadsheet that he's projected up at the front of the classroom.
So, residential and commercial, transportation, industrial.
Within those categories, Schrag's students have to fill in key numbers about America's energy future. How much comes from coal, oil, natural gas, biomass, renewables, even hydrogen? What energy efficiency rates are for cars and homes?
So it's very easy to fill out the spreadsheet. What's hard to do is do it in an intelligent way.
It's hard because the goal is to cut carbon emissions 83% by 2050. That was the Obama administration's official goal.
I don't want to say it's impossible to get to that level of reduction by 2050, but certainly it's, like, really hard.
This is Beverly Guh, who's a student in Schrag's class. She, Yuki Zwitowski, and Nick Durham are talking about how much they can rely on energy efficiency for these cuts.
Such a short time period to be able to increase your efficiency by
like
so much.
2050 seems far away, but 32
really
years does not.
These students already know part of the solution is to electrify everything they can.
So much easier if it's all one grid. Yeah. And you can use whatever renewable energy to power that grid.
But to generate that much electricity, the students have to put the solar and wind industries on steroids. Here's Zwitowski again.
We only have 1 gigawatt per year of solar. And we're trying to ramp it up to like 800 to 1,000, which is insane. But if you don't do that, then you're releasing too much carbon.
This 1,000-fold increase in solar didn't seem terribly realistic to them or to their professor.
Last year, we built 15 gigawatts of wind and solar in the U.S., which was a record.
Schrag says the kind of increase these students are talking about would take a long time.
At current construction rates, that's 500 years. Now, you can accelerate that. We can build more factories, but realize that solving the climate challenge is the biggest construction project the world's ever seen.
Of course, wind and solar are not the only possible answers.
Some students have pushed very heavily on advanced nuclear power. Some students have done enormous amounts with carbon capture and storage. There is no prescriptive recipe for doing well on this exercise.
In other words, there's no one right answer to Schrag's class project. So I ask him for the right answer in the real world.
So I think, unfortunately, I'm going to disappoint you.
Schrag says he can't be my energy oracle because there are too many open questions about the kinds of new technologies we need to get us off of carbon.
Is there going to be a next generation nuclear technology that's going to be much safer and less expensive? We don't know. Will battery prices go down enough so that storage of electricity from wind and solar becomes much more manageable? We don't know. And until you answer those sorts of questions, you really can't say what the right answer is.
You're right. That wasn't quite as satisfying as I was hoping for.
Schrag's real students are still working on their spreadsheets. For now, neither Beverly Guh nor Yuki Zwitowski thinks the goal of cutting carbon 83% by 2050 is going to happen.
I tend to think that we won't quite make it. Beverly and I were actually talking earlier this week that we need to have like an environmental science intervention club for us to let out our emotions about how hopeless this all feels.
Schrag warned them about that feeling when he first introduced this exercise in class.
There's a point of this course where all the students get kind of depressed, like, oh my God, this is so much harder than I thought. It's not about pessimism. It's about realism. Being optimistic through delusion is not helpful. Being optimistic really involves a value of whether we can climb the mountain we need to climb. What we're trying to do is first describe what the mountain is, and then think about what we have to do to get over it. Okay? All right, see you on Wednesday.
These students have 2 weeks to finish their spreadsheets and chart a path over that mountain. When they leave Harvard, some of them plan to tackle this problem out in the real world. So who knows? Maybe some of their ideas will leap off this spreadsheet and turn into real policy solutions. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Boston.
Students struggling in the classroom there to make the carbon numbers balance. Let's turn now to a company that's trying to push those numbers down out in that real world. Here's The World's Jason Margolis.
It's not every day you hear business leaders talk like this.
We are worried about climate change and the ability of the world to move fast enough.
Barry Parkin works with Mars. You know the name. They're the world's largest candy maker. They make Snickers, Skittles, and M&Ms. More and more companies are talking about climate change. But Mars is putting a big pile of money behind that talk with a $1 billion investment to cut its greenhouse gas pollution by two-thirds by the year 2050. Parkin, who is Mars's chief sustainability officer, says the move is definitely about investing in a healthier planet, but it's also about investing in the company itself.
Using less energy in your factories just saves you money. You know, the world has reached a tipping point on renewable energy where it's actually cheaper now in many countries than fossil fuel energy. So it's just good business, some of this.
Things like investing in a Texas wind farm the size of Paris. Mars is already using enough renewable electricity to run all of its factories in the U.S., the U.K., Brazil, Belgium, and Lithuania. It wants its roughly 150 factories worldwide to be carbon neutral by the year 2040.
So we're sort of marching around the world, making our plants more efficient.
The march is now reaching Ontario, Canada.
This is our newest facility. So
Dave Dusseng is the general manager for Mars Food Canada. Mars doesn't just produce candy. The newly expanded plant in the township of Bolton, just north of Toronto, churns out Uncle Ben's instant rice.
This facility can produce 140 tons a day, which is equivalent of 600,000 pouches.
That's a lot of rice and a lot of energy spent to process and package it. When Mars expanded this factory, energy cost savings were top of mind. The building has energy-efficient lighting, more efficient cooling, and plenty of natural light.
Toronto is cold. However, having the windows actually creates natural heating for the building and is helping us as part of our energy efficiency.
But the big energy cost here comes from cooking. To give us rice that we can pop in a microwave, they need to cook it here first. That means boiling lots and lots of water.
We've installed and put in a number of systems to be able to recirculate that water and recapture it.
That's Peter McDonald, the plant's operations manager. The cooking water used to be used once and then poured down the drain. No longer.
Back in about 2007, this factory was using roughly one-third of the water for the entire town. Once we went to recirculating, we actually had the city contact us saying, you know, what's going on?
Mars has lowered its water use here by 85%, and that means using a lot less energy as well. But sustainability chief Barry Parkin says changes like these in Ontario, that's just the start.
You know, I hope in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, we're not carving out what are we investing in sustainability, but it's just part of the way we do business.
Still, Mars has its critics.
We have to shift the focus from reducing unsustainability, doing less bad stuff, to doing more good stuff. That requires a fundamentally different approach.
Andrew Hoffman teaches sustainable business practices at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. He likes that Mars is taking a public stance on climate change, but says their efforts aren't enough, considering the urgency of the issue.
You know, scientists are expecting that 90% of the world's coral reefs will be gone by 2050. There's expectations that by 2100, as much as half of all present species could be extinct. There needs to be some really bold thinking, and I do look to the corporate sector to do it, and a reduction of 67% greenhouse gas emissions. I'd like to see them go carbon neutral.
Let me talk about Mars' billion-dollar commitment, because I do think it is a wildly impressive commitment.
Mindy Luber is the CEO of Ceres, a Boston-based organization that helps companies integrate sustainability practices into their work. She agrees that the private sector must do more, but is encouraged by the growing number of companies taking climate change seriously, like Mars.
Mars has stood up before it was popular to say acting on climate change is not only an important imperative for our kids' future, but it's a business imperative. They set goals and they work to meet them.
But cleaning up Mars's factories, that's the easy part. Factories produce just 10% of the company's greenhouse gas emissions. The bigger challenge will be tackling the company's agricultural supply chain, dramatically improving how all that cocoa and sugar and rice is grown. Mars says it's committed to freezing the company's land footprint and stopping deforestation. But the company came under fire just last month for buying palm oil from Indonesian land that used to be habitat for orangutans, rhinos, and leopards. Mars says it expects its suppliers to comply with environmental standards, but acknowledges the challenges. Back in Ontario, I asked Dave Dusang about the supply chain for rice. He says they've started a pilot program with farmers in Pakistan and India.
What we've been able to see is through improved farming practices, the production of rice has resulted in a third less use of water. And importantly for the farmers and their economic well-being, we've seen a 30% increase in the income that they're able to generate.
Meeting its environmental goals and appeasing the critics is going to be a big challenge for Mars. But the bigger challenge for the Earth may be how to get more companies to at least start trying. For The World, Jason Margolis, Bolton, Ontario.
Earlier this month, Mexicans and Mexican-Americans celebrated the Day of the Dead. Now, a Disney Pixar film is coming out featuring the holiday. It's a story of a Mexican boy who magically enters the land of the dead with his dog Dante on a quest to find his ancestors.
Dante, wait up! Dante! Dante! You gotta stay with me, boy! We don't know where we are. This isn't a dream, then. You're all really out there.
Coco opens here in the U.S. tomorrow, but it's out now in Mexico, where it's already the highest-grossing film of all time in the country. Rodrigo Cervantes of station KJZZ was at the premiere in Mexico City, where he heard from director Lee Unkrich.
It was also very interesting to watch this film, considering the political and economical tensions happening between the United States and Mexico. So I asked Mr. Unkrich about this, and this is what he said.
I think it's a good thing that it's coming out now. There's been a lot of negativity in the world as of late. We're honored to be bringing, hopefully, some much-needed positivity.
One of the writers on the film, Rodrigo, also said that Coco gets away from what we often hear about Mexico, you know, the tropes of corruption and cartels and all that negative talk from the White House about migrants. What is your take on the timing of this film coming out now?
Well, it is interesting to see the entire process on building Coco. This took around 6 years for Pixar to make it happen, and they constantly traveled around Mexico to learn more about the traditions and the culture. Probably they weren't planning to have it in this precise political and economical moment. However, it is clear that Pixar and Disney were very careful on trying to avoid any kind of stereotypes or any kind of allusions that make them look like they're imposing their vision. Let's remember that also Disney and Pixar had a controversy a few years ago when they started to be serious about this idea, and they registered it, they patented it as Día de los Muertos. This became a huge, huge controversy in several media outlets because it seemed like an American company was trying to patent or register a Mexican holiday.
What you're saying, though, is kind of fascinating because it sounds like Hollywood came to Mexico to do its due diligence on a film that is very much anchored to the culture of Mexico, and they felt the need to get it right. As a kid, do you remember seeing the stereotypes and what Hollywood got wrong?
Definitely. And I think we can still see those stereotypes happening in Hollywood. Latinos and Mexicans are portrayed as drug dealers, service people, sometimes as hostile characters. And this is slightly changing, but it was fascinating to see how easy it was probably to have a movie featuring an entire Latino cast. In this case, it was animated, yet still it is a cast that it's representing the entire Mexican community, but also as Adrian Molina, the co-director, told me, it was also about including all this diversity of talent behind the scenes. Mm. You have producers, you have voices, you have actors that are Mexican or Latino from the United States that are participating also in the production of this film.
KJZZ reporter Rodrigo Cervantes in Mexico City talking about the new Disney Pixar animated film Coco, which opens tomorrow here in the U.S. For the first time, officials in Egypt are preparing to display the complete collection of artifacts related to King Tut. Really? You want me to say the whole thing? Okay, fine. King Tutankhamun, or King Tut for short. Most of these artifacts have not even been seen since Tut's tomb was discovered by the British archaeologist Howard Carter in 1922. But now there's a plan to put all of them on show in a new museum being built near the Pyramids of Giza, due to open next March. Right now, the artifacts are being delivered to the site, where they're being carefully prepared in special labs. My BBC colleague Orla Guerin got a sneak preview.
Well, we're just coming into one of the labs now. You get hit by a blast of cold air as soon as you walk through the door. The temperature here is very carefully controlled. Specialist staff are working on objects from the collection of Tutankhamun.
The museum director, Dr. Tariq Taufik, gave us a sneak preview of exhibits that are being returned to their former glory.
They will give insights about the lifestyle of Tutankhamun. His footwear, his garments, his weaponry, his shields, everything that was really close to the king, objects that he used in daily life, one will see Tutankhamun in a totally new light.
So as he was living rather than as he died?
Exactly.
Tutankhamun's treasures are getting the kid glove treatment here, but it hasn't always been like this. In 2014, his golden death mask was damaged by maintenance staff at the Egyptian Museum in Tahrir Square. After knocking off the beard, they stuck it back crudely with glue. It took German experts 2 months to repair the damage.
Yeah, you always got to be careful with the beard. The BBC's Orla Guerin reporting there from Egypt. The holiday season is upon us, a joyous time for those flying to meet friends and family, showing up 3 hours before a flight, the security line, the pat-down, yes, so much fun. It's not like travel in 1950s America, where if you were flying overseas, you pretty much showed up at the airport with a passport and you were good to go. But where to go? What to see and do? Right after World War II, the world seemed ripe for discovery, and the record industry thought they could help and make some money in the process by teaming up with travel companies and then using records and record covers to sell vacation destinations. Yeah, they were kind of corny, but Janet Borgerson and Jonathan Schroeder saw and heard something in those old LPs and their covers, and they've curated a fascinating book called Designed for Hi-Fi Living, The Vinyl LP in Mid-Century America.
The first place we want to take you to is to Europe.
We're flying up to Europe on a holiday.
With European Holiday, an SAS-sponsored record that has Mitch Miller and his orchestra.
We'll find out what there is to see in all Cadiz. We'll join the skate Parisians watching champagne fizz.
Yeah, so SAS, the Scandinavian airline system, and it's just a wonderful kind of package that's co-sponsored by the airlines and Columbia Records, and it basically takes a young couple through how to take their first European trip. So it's kind of got an earnest, you know, travel agent. It's got some spoken word on the record. It's got some songs that introduce you to Europe. It tells you how to apply for a passport. It's really kind of a complete guide to traveling to Europe.
We fly you up to Scotland, then to England, then to France. At Nice, you sail to Naples on a ship built for romance. You cruise the Riviera, stop at Cairo and Beirut. We fly you back through Europe, Scandinavia's en route.
And SAS released this, apparently, because they were opening up some new travel routes. And we really see that the co-sponsorship here of the airline and the music and this notion of travel in the mid-century. From the European Holiday, there was the chance to go dancing at the Havana Hilton, and that takes us to a record album focused on Cuba.
Whenever we found Cuban records, we've been collecting records for over 20 years, we just were really fascinated because when we grew up, you know, Cuba was really off limits. We couldn't get Cuban products. So whenever we saw a Cuban record, we were really intrigued.
There's this beautiful blue cover, and the Havana Hilton on the cover of Dancing at the Havana Hilton is a beautiful hotel. It was designed by architect Belton Beckett, and you see the pool complex.
Basically, as soon as that hotel opened, the Cuban Revolution happened, and Castro, when he came into Havana, he commandeered the hotel, and it became the provisional headquarters for the rebels, and it was renamed Habana Libre, and from then on, it's been in the government's hands.
We love the idea of people leaving from Florida, hopping over to Cuba just for an evening to dance and play cards and drink rum. And after the hotel went into the hands of Castro, there was less Cuban rum.
And so the record kind of gets you ready for your trip to Cuba. It has cha-cha-chas and mambos and kind of typical Cuban music.
And if you never got to go to Cuba, you can just put the record on and dance in your living room.
Well, we'll turn next to one of the more exotic records in our book, Cairo, The Music of Modern Egypt. This is part of Capitol Records' Capitol of the World series, which featured over 400 LPs that featured music from around the world. This record in particular has a beautiful picture of the pyramids on the cover, a classic tourist shot of camels and the desert of Egypt.
The Capitol of the World records are fantastic in our eyes because they often have dual language texts in the liner notes. This one has a bit of Arabic, and when you listen to the music, it's quite lovely.
In collecting these records and writing the book, we've discovered just a real amazing range of music, photography, design. It's been a real learning experience to see the availability of records in that era. Just everything got recorded. There were a lot of spoken word records, there were advice records, also music, of course, but guides to becoming modern in post-war America.
Record collectors Jonathan Schroeder and Janet Borgerson, they co-wrote the new book, Designed for Hi-Fi Living, The Vinyl LP in Mid-Century America. We've got selections from the book at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Safe travels this week. We hope you'll stop over with us tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.